The whole theme of Ecclesiastes starts with the words in the NIV, meaningless, meaningless, everything's meaningless. Solomon, who we believe wrote the book, is bringing attention to the fact that life is brief, and actually the word is used in different ways throughout the book. And right at the beginning, it's used in this sense, brief, brief, everything's brief, life is brief. And that's my first life lesson. It's brief. Very brief. And the older you get, the briefer it feels. My husband, where he was staying with an old lady of 80 years of age in a place he was ministering, and she was driving him to the meetings every day. Now, my husband's big and he's tough. The only thing that makes him go white with fear is if I'm driving him or if a little old lady of 80 is driving him. But she was worse than me, and she would take off to these meetings, and she would go at this incredible pace. And he was somewhere else when she wanted to get to the meeting. She didn't take him that morning, and she was clocked at going at 85 miles an hour down the main street of this town. And the police, of course, pulled her over. And they said, Do you know what speed you're going? Now, it's one of these towns in America where everybody, even the policemen, are in their 80s. So it's one of these old places. But he was appalled at this. And she said, no, how fast was I going, officer? And he said, 85 miles an hour. And she said, well, there's an explanation. He said, what is it? She said, well, I had to get there before I forgot where I was going. Yes. As I thought about grouping the lessons that I've learned about following hard and sticking with it and enduring and getting to the end, finishing strong and all of that, I grouped them under three headings: worship, worth, and work. And as I've tried to gather my own thoughts, and a lot of this will be story and testimony, as I've tried to figure out what are the life lessons that I have learned in following Jesus, being a Jesus lover and a glory giver, they certainly fall into these three categories. And I want to start with worship. And the first life lesson, as I think about it, is that it has been absolutely imperative for me to develop spiritual intimacy with God. I think that is definitely my major life lesson as I look back. I have been reading this wonderful book, Tozer's book. I'm sure you've all read The Pursuit of God and Knowledge of the Holy One. And actually, I got to choose it because there's a library been made of classics, and they chose some people in America to choose. And all I had to do was to choose my top 10 books. And, you know, about 100 leaders chose theirs, and then they did all the computations, and they've made a library of the classics that we chose. So I thought, how neat. All I have to do is to read a lot of books and figure out which of the 10 I like. And so it's been a wonderful blessing to me. But in this book, Tozer says, there's a whole chapter on the gaze of the soul. His phrases are incredible. If you haven't read Tozer at all, and I hadn't read too much of it, you need to get into this, the gaze of the soul. And he says, when the eyes of the soul looking out meet the eyes of the soul looking in, heaven has begun right here on earth. And he talks about the eyes of our soul looking into heaven and looking into the eyes of God and meeting the eyes of God looking in. And in the measure that I have developed my spiritual intimacy with God in the interior places of my soul, that is the measure that I've been effective in other people's lives. And if we want to reproduce life in others, discern where they are, and take them to the next level, that's all. Just one step. Then we will do that effectively in the measure that we are developing the chamber of our soul and what happens there. And so my life impact rises or falls on how well I guard and grow this time. And I have to find myself time, and I have to pray myself quiet, and I have to keep myself still long enough to see enough, to hear enough, to learn enough, to change enough of me forever. And if I will take that on as a challenge in the whole of my life, then I will be effective in the lives of other people. And so through my life, I've tried to ask myself, not have I done my devotions for the day, but really rather, have I heard the quiet whispers of His grace? Right here. Right now. And it shows. It's a sort of unconscious thing, or should be, when we practice it. But it shows. People beat a path to your life. So how are you doing interiorly? I can never say that, so I shouldn't try. But I think to myself, have I today prayed, revive me, O Lord? I am hugely privileged to work with Anne Graham Lotz. We have just been in the Royal Albert Hall in London doing a Just Give Me Jesus there. And that, for all sorts of reasons, was one of the high points of my life in ministry. This is my country. This is my England here. And this particular building, I don't know if any of you know the importance of the Royal Albert Hall, but whenever you hear the London Philharmonic, it comes from the Royal Albert Hall. It's a very, very old, incredible building. It goes up tier after tier after tier after tier. It's not that big, holds about 8,000 people. And actually, you can't see the people in the tiers. It's the old-fashioned sort of theater style. The acoustics are second to none in the world. And you don't need microphones. And here we were in this place, but that wasn't why I was so excited about this event. It was because years ago I was in that hall, and that's the last time I've been there. I was 18 years of age, and I had just been converted at Cambridge. And I don't know, maybe I was 3 or 4 months old in Christ, but the girl that led me to the Lord was working for the Billy Graham Crusade, and he was just beginning Haringey. And Haringey was when God took that young evangelist, Billy Graham, and threw his cloak over him and hid him and showed the world Jesus through his life. And I got to hear Billy Graham in the Royal Albert Hall. He was not talking to the general public. He was talking to the workers of Haringey. He was 3 months in London, night after night after night in Haringey Sports Arena. And this was the kickoff. And so he got all the councillors and all the workers and all the volunteers together in this place, filled it. And I got to go because the girl that had led me to Christ was helping as a volunteer in the office, and she said, you can come along with me. And I was sitting there, just looking around and thought, yes, where was I now? Was it up there on that tier? But I know I was up. And he gave an appeal for full-time commitment. We're giving your life away, you know, just investing your life. And I was absolutely mesmerized, absolutely mesmerized. Listen, here I am years later with his daughter standing on that stage with an hour and a half to minister. Can you imagine what that was like for me? It's my home turf. My England, that I left, been guilty about that many times, to come here. And God gave me that opportunity. And as we began our prayer and worship time, I prayed a prayer that I wrote years and years ago for everybody and turned it into our, but I'll turn it back to mine. A prayer for revival. Oh, dear Lord, it's been a while since my sluggish spirit has felt alive, really alive. My faith feels stuffy. It needs freshening. I need to throw open the windows of my soul and let the fresh air of heaven in. Revive me, O Lord. Help me to so sharpen my prayer skills so that I get down on my knees with my face to the rising sun and never want to get up again. Teach me to glance heavenwards a million times a day. Find your guiding eye, my soul looking out, his eyes looking in. Make my time with you fragrant, like treading barefoot on wet grass, clear shining after rain. Revive me, O Lord. And as the meeting came to an end, and I had the huge joy of having Stuart there with me, he's never been to one of those revivals that we've done. We reveled in being there in that place together. And as I had that privilege, I mentioned that I had been at Homerton College in Cambridge, and a whole group of people somewhere up there started to shout and clap. And I said, oh, were you there too? And a voice came right out in this whole arena. Yes, Jill, it's Mary. I said, oh, Mary, I can't believe this. Because she was the Christian Union leader in the college when I was saved. I haven't seen her since, of course, and I couldn't see her then. She was somewhere up there. But afterwards, she came up to me, and she just looked the same, except years later. I said, we stood and looked at each other, and we said, you just look the same, you just look the same. It was absolutely incredible. And she said, Jill, did you ever know what trouble you gave us? And I said, no, I've no idea. She said, did nobody ever tell you how many times Grace and me were hauled in to the authorities at college because of you? I said, I've no idea. What's this story? And apparently, I have no idea why, I gave them a lot of trouble. And she said to me, you're just the same. Your passion's there. And she said, it caused so much trouble for college and for us. She said, there were complaints that you didn't do any writing in lectures. You were writing all your follow-up letters to all the people you were leading to Christ. And then there was the play. Well, I remember the play. I was doing drama, and I did not have a very clean mouth before I was a Christian, and I was always chosen to do the raunchy parts in plays, maybe because they knew I could really do them with fervor and vigor. And I got saved. Well, as I went back to drama class out of hospital, I suddenly thought, oh. And I was in a Greek tragedy or something, and I had the first piece, the prologue, which is just standing up there and doing the prologue, and it was laced with words that I suddenly realized I could no longer say. What am I going to do? And it was nearly time to do this play. So I went to almost the dress rehearsal, and I had taken my script and taken out all of these words. It made absolutely no sense at all. But I did it without one bad word in it. And everybody sat there and looked at me. And my drama teacher came up and said, have you gone crazy? What have you done to the script? And I said, well, I can't say those words anymore. I'm so sorry. What do you mean you can't say those words anymore? This is what we are using in a competition for the whole of England. And you are the prologue. And you have just taken and sliced up because you've taken out all the words. I'm sorry, I can't do that anymore. Well, apparently Mary was hauled in to the principal and said, do something with this crazy woman who's gone all religious maniac on us and get her to do this play. So it was wonderful seeing Mary again and learning about this. Two words I've learned about this caring for my soul. Intentional discipline, well, that's two words. I have to be intentional in the discipline of this. I have to pray on purpose. I mean, I have to really mean this. I have to if I'm going to get anywhere with God so others get somewhere with God, I have to go after it. I have to pant after God. Do you pant after God? I mean, really. Like a deer that needs a drink that's been chased and hounded. Is that your soul? Aura. And I have to be intentional. I have to have a plan, a spiritual plan. I've got ministry plans. I've got travel plans. I've got book plans. Do I have a soul plan? What's on your list to stretch the sides of your soul this year, this month? Or is it filled with all these other plans? One of the things that has kept me fresh in all of this is to never stop dreaming and dream big. Your young men will see visions. Your old men and women will dream dreams. We're supposed to be dreaming. And the older you get, the more you should be dreaming. You should never stop dreaming. When we first started the women's ministry and somebody said, you know, Jill, you need to get this committee organized. I'm an instigator, so I rush around instigating stuff. And then all the bits start falling of what I'm doing, and I don't know how to organize the blessing. But fortunately, other people do. And so my poor committee was desperately trying to organize all these things I was blowing up, and all the bits were falling down. And there was lots happening, but it was like a body, somebody explained to me, running around without a skeleton in it, this women's ministry. And one of my good friends came and said, Jill, you started all this stuff, and this women's ministry is like a body. Could I put the skeleton in for you? Now, there's a difference between leadership and management. And America, I think, has got this mixed up. Leadership is the vision. Leadership is the dreamer. Leadership says, yes! Go on, let's reach for it. Go for the gold. Yes, it can happen. Like, I got this dream, this vision of planting this women's ministry that we got going, and it was a dream, it was a vision. And I set off and I begin to make it happen. But I can't manage it. And if you get managers doing what visionaries are supposed to do, then you will do it better and better and better, and you'll kill it in the end. You need both. You need your leaders, you need your dreamers, you need your visionaries. And when somebody explained that to me, we made sure we had a dreamer on every committee. And they would say, what do you want me to do? And I'd say, sit on that chair, honey, just dream, that's it. It's your job. Think up things for us. Just, you know, doesn't matter, don't start to say, but how could and how much. Dream! Oh, and they love that. Dreamers love to be invited to do that. And then, of course, you've got your administrator and you've got your people that manage the blessing that she dreams up or makes the dream happen. And I believe that even those of us that are managers can dream. All of us need to dream. Ask God for a dream. I've been to Romania. And here there are women in the former Soviet Union and wonderful women who got together for a leadership conference. They have no resources. They have absolutely no resources. They've had no training. There's a whole group there from Moldova, former Soviet Union, speak Russian. They're Russian women. All that sweep of villages, untouched, unreached, where they live. They come to the conference to find out how to reach them. First training they'd ever had. And the leader of the conference said, now we've got a rather strange program. We're going to have one main session, and then we're going to have an hour, and you're going away without anybody near you, and you're going to process it with God. And you come back and tell us what he said to you about what you've just heard. Then we're going to have another main session, then we're going to send you away for another hour. And the first session she took was on vision. What is your vision? And they all went away, 400 or 500 women from all over that area, all over that country, and they dreamed. Ask God for a dream, for a vision. What could happen in Moldova? What could happen? And then they came back. And I'll never forget this group of Russian women standing up to report, struggling with the language and managing quite well, and saying, God gave us all the same vision and dream, all 50 of us that came. And the dream is to get ourselves into teams and to do what you have taught us to do in BEE, just basic Bible training they've been in for 2 years, and to take it to every village. And we're going to do it, we're going to do it in threes and fours, and we're going to just take a week out of our year, and we got organized, and he gave us all the same dream. None of us talked to each other until we came back. And they dreamed. They dreamed. They dreamed. And we need to give them time to process. We just throw all this stuff at them. But they need to go away and look out into the eyes of God and let his eyes look in and say, yeah, that's a good dream. That's my dream. Let's do it. So where are you going interiorly? That's one of my life lessons. And the other word is submission. My submission to God must be unconditional, moment by moment and day to day. That is a life lesson. I must be submitted to God. I must be giving him no conditions. I will serve this if I serve for half a year. I cannot serve in the summer because of my family. That is a condition. Well, obviously my responsibility is to my children. What about other people's children that nobody's ever prayed for once? How many times have your kids been prayed for? Does God take the summer off? Do people live and die in the summer? Without ever having heard of Jesus, of course. But we put all these conditions. And I have learned, it's one of my life lessons, no conditions. If I say I'm surrendered, I'm surrendered. I'm surrendered in the winter, I'm surrendered in the summer. I'm surrendered in the spring, I'm surrendered in the autumn. And it might be that God will say, look after your own children. That is what I have in mind for you today. And it might be the next day he says, go and look after somebody else's children. You are obedient, you are surrendered. Because if you're not, God is limited. Can we limit God? Apparently, yes. That's a thought. And it's something we'll be held accountable for. To whom much is given, much will be required. And this is one of my life lessons. If I can live like this, it will be a fragrant thing. People will be attracted to a surrendered life. And someone who is interiorly never satisfied. And someone who is unconsciously showing Christ. And it is an unconscious thing. A woman talked to me not long ago and she said, are you filled with the Spirit? And I said, I have no idea. And if I am, I don't know it. Because one of the fruits of the Spirit is humility. Well, she didn't like that answer. I said, are you filled with the Spirit? She said, yes, I am. I said, no, you're not. Because anybody filled with the Spirit doesn't know it. They're so super conscious, they're not there yet. Like Paul said, I'm detained. I want to know more and more. I want to know him in his death and his resurrection, all of that. But don't think I've attained. He was full of the Spirit. But the more full of the Spirit you are, the more conscious of what there is that you're not full of. And what hasn't been dealt with. And you become more and more dissatisfied with your spiritual health. Not only by the words you say, not only by your deeds confessed, but in the most unconscious way is Christ expressed. Is it a beautiful smile, a holy light upon your ground? No, I felt his presence when you laughed just now. And from your eyes he beckons me. From your heart his love is shared till I lose sight of you and see the Christ instead. Is that what people see in your life? You say, oh, I don't think so. You're full of the Spirit. And there's a fragrant aroma. Paul talks about a scent of Jesus. Is that what people scent of us? So my number one lesson, the more I love God, the more those I teach, lead, mentor, and train will love him too. My job is to love God. That's my job. My spiritual job, it's yours too. First and foremost, are you loving God? Do you love him more this week than you did last week? What is it going to take to do that? Till you are so enamored of him, everything else gets in the way. You have come here to get materials. And you have come to gather them for other people. Make sure you gather your own health. So that's a life lesson. And you know, you can only take people as far as you've gone yourself. Another life lesson. I learned that when I was in youth evangelism. I could only take the kids that were coming to Christ as far as I'd gone myself. And the whole art of ministry is staying one step ahead of the person you're leading. Just one step. That's all you need. Just stay ahead of them. It's hard, isn't it? But you can only take people to the level that you're at. How can you take them further than you've been yourself? Possible. Life lesson. So I find myself time to keep myself quiet and pray myself still. I develop spiritual intimacy. And then secondly, I develop spiritual intelligence. It's called wisdom or insight. Spiritual intelligence is wisdom that knows truth, discerns error, understands life. It's skilled living. The whole thing of wisdom, of course I'm back in Ecclesiastes here, but Ecclesiastes teaches that wisdom is spiritual intelligence. It's an intelligence that gives you insight into other people, as Solomon demonstrated when they brought that baby to him, remember the story. And what do you do with a dilemma like that? And God gave him spiritual intelligence, insight, ideas of finding out who that baby belonged to. Remember the story. It was a wonderful thing to watch. Practical skill, practical wisdom, skill to handle life. Do you ever listen and shake your head internally and say, how did they ever get in a mess like this? And how could they get dressed and come to this meeting? Their life is such a twisted mess. It beats anything on television that you can imagine. And they've come to me and they've said, in 1 hour of your time, would you undo 25 years of the mess I've made of my life? Right. Now, who is sufficient for these things? I'm certainly not, but he is. Because we need wisdom. We need to say like Solomon, give me a sword. Give me an idea. This is totally beyond me. Give me insight. Why is this person behaving like this? How did they get their life in such a mess? And what is it that I need to start with in this mess to unravel? Now, for this, we need Jesus, but for this, we have Jesus. And he is our wisdom. He is the one that will practically help us with the life skill, which is what wisdom means, for this woman. I remember listening to my husband counsel a couple whose lives were in a total mess. Their marriage, by all accounts, was finished. And I remember him and I listening with my mouth falling open to what had happened in their life, where they were then, and thinking. And I thought, what is my husband going to say? What little cliche, what book, what, you know, what's going to do this? What's going to fix this? I couldn't imagine. And he listened very carefully, and then I watched his spiritual intelligence at work, because my husband is a very wise man. And he said, you know, I've listened to your dilemma and to your problems. And I suspect there is no answer. Well, that was a, you know. You don't tell people there isn't an answer. But that's what he did. And then he said, but I will help you live well in an impossible situation. I suspect there is no answer. But what you need to do is to live well. And so, I will help you to do that piece. And maybe God will unravel the mess. Maybe he won't. I suspect he won't. But if he doesn't, you will be living well in it. So you can live in an impossible marriage well. Now, the wisdom I watched working in Stuart was very practical. He began to help them with their budget because they were in debt, nearly bankrupt. And I watched his skill and wisdom, his spiritual intelligence and his insight, getting to the nub of it, taking them off, I need to fix it, and telling them, you probably can't, but let's start with you. So that God will not probably change your circumstances, but he can change you. He can not only help you survive this, he can help you rescue your children in it, and this is what I suggest. And so that's the sort of thing that wisdom is about. And I need this spiritual intelligence, and I have it in Jesus. That's been a life lesson. Tozer was homeschooled himself. there wasn't homeschooling in those days. We have to homeschool ourselves in these matters. I'm amazed that he never had any formal theological training, nor did Spurgeon. But they homeschooled themselves, and they became wise beyond their years. Spurgeon was young, but he was wise. And in his sermons, they are laced with practical wisdom and help. Now, how are you doing with that? And I have realized that I have to develop that spiritual intelligence. Thirdly, I have to develop spiritual integrity. Spiritual intimacy, spiritual intelligence, spiritual integrity. Now, integrate, as you know, means putting your spirituality and your practical living together. I have to practice what I preach. I have to put my faith and practice together. I have to put my behavior and belief together. A young man came up to me at the end of the service. My husband had preached a very powerful message on sexual purity or something in that area. And so I said, "Can I help you?" And he said, "Yes, I have a real dilemma." He said, "I'm living with my girlfriend. I've been living with my girlfriend for quite a while. And I really don't know what to do about it. That sermon really got to me." And I said, "Are you a believer?" He said, "Yes, I've been a Christian all my life." I said, "Is she a believer?" And he said, "No, she isn't." But he said, "We've been together a long time." And I said, "Why don't you marry her? Why don't you get married?" And he said, "Oh, she's not a Christian." Isn't that amazing? Just didn't make the connection. And he said, "I know the Bible says you mustn't be unequally yoked to an unbeliever, so how can I marry her? So I have a real dilemma." And he couldn't put faith and practice together. It was a glaring thing. Yes, you shouldn't marry an unbeliever, but you also shouldn't live with somebody. But he couldn't get the two together, you know? And that's what our church is riddled with today. Integrity is putting what you know into the obedience that brings a holy lifestyle out of it, the balanced lifestyle, to integrate. For us, many of us, that's obvious. It's more subtle. Tozer talks about spiritual maladjustment, how that when Jesus moved among men, he was totally poised and restful, but he was able to put his spirituality into practical lessons, like the carpenter's shop. Somebody didn't pay their bills. What do you do about that? Well, God gave him wisdom to handle that practical life skill, I'm sure. And he was able to integrate what was right with dealing with something that was wrong on a very local, ordinary basis. It's called the sacrament of living. And I've read so much lately about one of the great hindrances to internal peace is the habit of us dividing our secular and spiritual life. So spiritual is singing hymns and coming to conferences and doing Bible study and witnessing. And secular is washing dishes and caring for the kids or going to work and being a secretary. And we feel guilty over here because we're not giving enough time to the spiritual because we're being secular. And that led to Gnosticism in the first century, that the body was somehow evil and only the spirit was good. And what we have to do is integrate and realize that secular work is spiritual. To work is to worship. To worship is to work. And there is no difference. Every act can be offered to God as an offering. Let us practice the fine art of making every act a priestly ministration. Wow, what a challenge that is. Another book that's just coming out is, it's really my Conversations with God. And I'm going to finish with one of the pieces of the same lesson that I learned years and years ago. Do you ever have days when you have all your time wonderfully organized and then you get nothing done as planned because of constant interruptions? People mess it all up. Well, it was the end of such a day, I carried my complaints to the front door and I sat down. I couldn't wait for him to come, but the door was shut and he didn't immediately appear. I was irritated because my day had been full of interruptions and I couldn't wait to start griping about it. Well, a thought occurred to me that I had come to complain about all my interruptions, but I was going to interrupt him doing whatever he was doing Well, I reasoned that was different. It was his job to drop everything and tend to me. Well, I began to think about my messy day. I had it all scheduled, and then it began. I no sooner got going when the phone rings, the kids call, the washing machine overflows, the dog runs away. A needy person appeared from nowhere and demanded my attention. I hate that. Well, she didn't fare too well. I tried to listen to her litany of woes, but I had my eye on the clock, and she caught me glancing at it every 2 minutes. She left hurriedly, feeling unwelcome and cared for and loved, and as empty as she came. And I felt a twinge of guilt, but thankfully it soon passed. And I hurried out the door of my conscience by all my righteous excuses. Well, I assured myself it was her fault. She hadn't made an appointment. I made it for her, a voice said in my ear. I jumped. I hadn't seen him arrive. You made the appointment, I asked, as if he was speaking so quietly I couldn't hear him. He knows I'm a little deaf. And then, but you didn't check with me first. Well, you didn't check with me either, he pointed out mildly, sitting down. I noticed he had some plans in his hands. I managed to peek surreptitiously at the papers, and they looked incredibly complicated. Had I interrupted some grand cosmic meeting where the Trinity was looking at creating a few more universes? What's the matter? He asked kindly. Well, I began my litany of woes, and I talked for at least 20 minutes without stopping. And after all, I had a lot of interruptions, and I wanted to make sure I complained about every single one of them. And I suddenly noticed he hadn't looked at his watch once. He was just sitting there, and I knew I was center stage in his thinking. And I thought about the grand cosmic plans in his hands, and then I thought about all my petty little gripes. And the worried woman's face kept appearing in my mind, and I tried hard to ignore it. What had he said, that he had made the appointment for me? She needed you, he said simply, following my thoughts. But Lord, you know what my schedule looked like, I argued. You had a choice, he replied. It's really quite simple. People matter more than schedules. When I lived outside the front door, he said, I was constantly interrupted by the multitude, but I believe my Heavenly Father made my day, and he knew he could interrupt. He could take my schedule and write anything he wanted over the plans that I had. Oh, I muttered miserably. Well, he didn't pat me on the head and say, there, there, it doesn't really matter, or hit me over the head with a verse from his book. He just sat there, and I looked at him carefully, and then I noticed he was praying. And I didn't want to interrupt that, so I stayed very still. I was certain he was praying for me. When he stopped, I said, thank you, Lord, for praying for me. I wasn't, he replied calmly. I was praying for her. The woman I sent to interrupt you. Now I was speechless. Well, that was good. He left then. I got to my feet and I reached out to him, and he turned at the door and looked right through me. And I knew he was looking right at my heart. Is it hard? I whispered. Yes, he said. Soften it, Lord, please. All right. Please, Lord, if it's not too late, send her back to me tomorrow. But your schedule's full of things to do. Please, Lord, I'll be waiting. There was a long silence, and then he was gone. And she didn't come back. Why should she? What did I miss that day? Who else received the blessing of investing in her life? What a loss. One of my life lessons. People matter. Pray with me. Lord God, would you in your grace forgive us? In your mercy, make us like your sweet son. In your love, give us another day to love the woman and the man. May they not be disappointed. Interrupt my pettiness with the things of internal importance. Teach me to let you fill in my schedule. Grant me another day. And another way to live. For Jesus' sake.